Gathered again this morning, this afternoon, to study your word. Father, I pray that you would just grant us your spirit once again to give us ears to hear and minds and hearts to understand. Lord, as we look into this book of Ruth and see its significance in redemption history, I pray that you would just open our eyes, give us a deeper and a fuller revelation. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Fortunately, this is only a 3-page book, so we'll be out of here. And if any of you believe that, the Book of Ruth. Its name comes from the principal character in the book. The setting of the book is in chapter 1, verse 1, in the days of the judges. And it's interesting that Judges ends, the previous book ends with that, and Ruth starts with that. In the days of the judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There was a real sense in those days of political anarchy. Boy, that's getting closer today again. There was no common governing authority. The situation was a land dominated by relativism, whatever feels good to you. And again, that's nothing new under the sun. God's word no longer was a standard. The people trust in themselves and other, quote, gods, and they're no longer living as the covenantal people of God, which they had said they would do. The story takes place during a famine in the land, which, again, if you were a covenant people of God and there's a famine, what would you or should you suspect is happening? Judgment. God is judging the land. Something has gone wrong. This is bad news. Leviticus 26, 18 and following says, if also after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride and power. I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. Your strength will be spent uselessly, for your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit. So right in the books of Moses, it says very clearly what is the result, why is a famine happening. And that is one thing I would submit to you in our day and age. We never ask those questions anymore. Many of you on last week, Hurricane Patricia, you know, this monster storm hit Mexico and parts of Texas, and Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Andrew, earthquakes. We never ask the question, I wonder why. What's that? Oh, that's right. It's fracking. It's not God. We don't really have a supernatural worldview. And I would submit to you, to the extent that we do not have a supernatural worldview, is the extent to which we do not have a biblical worldview. It's a time of moral confusion, of disobedience, unfaithfulness, which often result, as we see in this story, in physical hardship. Some interesting notes about the book of Ruth in chapter 1, verses 6 through 22. The word return appears 12 times, at least in the Hebrew. It may be translated differently, but it's often used to refer to spiritual renewal. And you can look this up later, but in Hosea chapter 3, 5, 6, 1, and 7, 10, that word return is used specifically, if you return to me. And the people return to the Lord. And that sense of returning carries within it spiritual ramifications of coming back to God. And so even here in the book of Ruth, we see echoes of that. The meanings of the names in Ruth are important. to the story, actually, and actually it's brought out within the story. Some of them, the name of Naomi specifically is brought out, but the name of her husband, Elimelech, is God is my king. And it's interesting, he's from the tribe of Judah, the kingly tribe. And his name recalls that. God is my king. The name of her first, or one of her sons, Mahlon, the one who died in Moab, means wick, or weak, or sick, sickly. The name of Chilion, her other son, means to be spent, at an end, decimated. Now, what parent names their kids that? You know, but they lived up to their names. They didn't live too long. Naomi, in chapter 1, verse 2, means sweet or pleasant, delightful. But when she comes back, she said, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. Bitter. I left full and I came back empty. Her name change echoes her radically changed circumstances from when she left to when she comes back. Ruth's sister-in-law, Orpah, means back of the neck, or stubborn, or obstinate. And she was one who turned away from Naomi's people. She did not go back with Naomi as Ruth did, but she went back to her own people. She turned away. The name of Ruth means to associate with, friendship. Ruth is one who embraces God's people, the land and Naomi's God. It's interesting that her name, as the Jewish people, we talked about this before, the name Ruth is Resh, Vav, and Tav, three letters. They add up to 606 in the Hebrew alphabet. If you add seven more, the seven laws that were given to Noah, you come to, surprise, surprise, 613, which were the number of commandments. And so the people see within that Ruth had a yearning, a longing to follow God's commands. I think it's a stretch, but it's interesting nonetheless. And then we could go on looking at, in chapter 4, they talk about the generations leading up to King David. And we'll look at that a little later. But Perez, they start with Perez, means to break through. And we'll look at that a little later. And then it goes, you could look at all the various names all the way up to King David. The book of Ruth, if you read it, if you were to sit in one setting and you come to the end of the book of Ruth, you would find Ruth anticipates the line of David. The book of Ruth points to the monarchy that is still coming. It is not yet here because it says in the days of the judges, that's when the book is written, or not when it's written, but the setting of the book, it's looking forward to King David. According to Jewish tradition, Ruth was a Moabite princess, daughter of the king of Moab. Again, it's not in the scripture, we don't know. A couple of the key verses are chapter 1, verse 16, and chapter 3, verse 11. Chapter 1 is, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Where you go, I will go. Where you lie down, I will lie down. Where you are buried, I will be buried. And chapter 3:11 talks about Ruth was a woman of excellence. What's interesting is that Ruth in the Hebrew Bible follows the book of Proverbs. Does anybody know what Proverbs 31 is all about?
The bionic woman.
The woman of excellence. And the very next book puts on display, in the Hebrew Bible at least, a woman of excellence. The only quotation from Ruth in the New Testament is found in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew's genealogy. That's the only place Ruth is quoted in the New Testament. As far as the author of Ruth, technically the short answer is we don't know. The author is anonymous. Some say it was Solomon who wrote the book after the death of his father David. The Babylonian Talmud considers Samuel the author. There are a lot of similarities between Samuel and the book of Ruth. Some argue the same author for both Judges and Ruth, as they may have both been part of the same scroll at one time. We don't know. The dating of the book of Ruth, some say the 5th century B.C. The earliest date it could have been written would have been during the time of David, after the days of the judges are over and the monarchy has come, because the lineage leads up to David within the book. So that's probably the earliest it could have been written. David's rise to power was around 1010 BC to 970 BC, so that would be an early date. Chapter 4, verse 7 seems to point to a later date, because they're talking about the kinsman redeemer in chapter 4 with Boaz and the other relative, and he declines, and it says in chapter 4, 7, that it was a custom in Israel in those days that the man would take off his sandal. And so it seems to be pointing as though times have changed, customs have changed, and they're looking back in time. So it may have been written much later, but again, we don't really know. The general outline you can see there, Naomi is emptied, and then Ruth gleans in the fields. Ruth visits Boaz at the threshing floor. Boaz redeems Ruth. And finally, Naomi is filled once again. Some theological themes. Emptiness to fullness. This is a story of how God fills a people who are empty and brings them to fullness, having lost all the men in her life. Her two sons and her husband left Naomi in a state of poverty, and she is filled through Ruth and Boaz. Naomi in the story is in a horrible predicament, because as a widow with no males to take care of her, she is literally on her own, and that is not a good place to be. Another theme is the cost of disobedience. There are consequences to sin. It can be forgiven, but we still suffer the consequences of it. What did Elimelech do that was disobedient? He did several things. He did what now? He gave his sons to foreign wives. But what did he do before that? That was a sin. He left community. He left Bethlehem. He left the land. And he went to a foreign land. Had his sons marry daughters or women that were foreigners. He places his family underneath the authority, if you will, of the Moabites. Which, again, is not good. And His actions result in poverty, death, and widowhood for his wife. So there is a cost to disobedience. Always has been, always will be. Some things never change. The sovereignty of God is another one that comes through writ large. God is at work, even in the midst of disobedience, bringing about His will for the nation. And not only for the nation of Israel, by, you see in the last part of chapter 4, by raising up the lineage of David, but also for the nation of Moab, by preserving Moab for such a time as this. It's a picture of God's unconditional election of Ruth to be a part of the messianic line. It's a story of God engrafting a people who are not His people into His people. We see Ruth show up in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew. And God sovereignly and providentially preserves the line of the Messiah in this story through a foreigner. And that has happened a number of times in Jesus' genealogy. Faithful living. Boaz and Ruth are depicted as those who live faithfully with integrity. They put their faith on display by how they live and act and conduct their lives. You can often tell the depth of a person's faith by how they conduct their lives. If our faith is on display for better or for worse. The theme of redemption. Redemption is really at the heart of the book of Ruth. The whole issue, the whole theme of redemption. Redemption was a Hebrew custom in which something or someone alienated might be restored to a family by a kinsman redeemer. This redemption is a picture of God's redeeming, buying back the lost, the alienated, and restoring them to His family. And we see that, I think, most obviously magnificently in the person of Christ. You know, 1 Timothy 2:5 says, there is one mediator between God and man, the man, Christ Jesus. He is our Redeemer. And it's interesting that God has built redemption almost into the very, it's in the very fabric of the nation. Because even without a kinsman redeemer, what was to happen every 50 years? The year of Jubilee, the Shemitah, that things were to revert back so that your land, you could never lose your land permanently. There was almost this sense of redemption built into the fabric, the economy, if you will, of the nation of Israel. Just going on, looking at the issue of Christ in Ruth, the stories about a redeemer, as we just said, which looks to the coming King David, but ultimately to the King of Kings, our Redeemer. It's a story of types and shadows, of looking ahead and giving us sort of hints and clues pointing to someone greater than Ruth and Boaz. It's a story of a covenant-keeping God. And then some other notes. It's interesting in chapter 3, verse 4, Naomi tells Ruth to do this. She's giving Ruth instructions. Okay, well, here's what I want you to do. Go to Boaz at the threshing floor, and the threshing floors in those days were often built on a hill, the top of a hill, and they would bring in the wheat during the day and crush it, and then around 4 o'clock, give or take, for a short while, there would be a cool breeze that would blow in. And that's when they would throw the grain up in the air, and the chaff would be blown away, and the wheat would fall to the ground. Well, Naomi tells Ruth, okay, when it's dark, go up, because Boaz is going to, they would often, the peasants would often lay sleep on the threshing floor. And she says, go and lay down at his feet, and he'll tell you what to do after that. Because remember, she's a Moabite. She's not an Israelite. So the customs are different in different countries. But she doesn't stop there. It says in 3 verse 9, Ruth is very bold and basically declares, marry me, will you? Spread your garment over me. And that is, in Israelite, in Hebrew custom, for a man to take his cloak, his robe, and spread it over the woman is basically to tell the world, she's mine, she's underneath my authority, I am now going to marry her. And so when Ruth is doing this, she's basically telling Boaz, I want you to marry me. And she doesn't wait for him to tell her the rest. No, she's a woman with guts. It's to enter into a marriage covenant. It's interesting in chapter 2, verse 12. Boaz prays a prayer for Ruth. May God bless you, and on and on. And then in chapter 3, verse 9, Boaz is the answer to his own prayer for Ruth. It's also she's going to cover me with his garment. Not only is it entering into a marriage contract, but it's also entering into an understanding. I think there's drawing symbolism. What was over the ark? Anybody know? In the tent? In the temple? Come on, what was built over the ark? Cherubim. The angels, their wings would touch. They were a covering representing the presence of God over the ark. So not only is she, there's a sense of a symbolic, yes, I want you to marry me, but there's also a sense of coming underneath that authority that is being, I think, played out there also. In Ruth chapter 3:11, Ruth is, it says she's a woman of excellence, a worthy woman. And I mentioned that already. It comes right after Proverbs 31. In chapter 4, verse 7, I looked and looked and looked. There's this guy pulling off his sandal. And basically you read the commentaries and they'll basically tell you in a nutshell, we have no clue what that means. It does show up in Deuteronomy 25, 9 to 10, and Amos 8, verse 6 about pulling off a sandal, but those are different contexts. It has something to do with that is how you legally put a contract or denied a contract, because the kinsman that takes his sandal off is handing his sandal to Boaz and basically saying, by this, I am relinquishing my rights as being the kinsman redeemer. They're really not sure what that all means, but it's one of those things that got lost in history. Going back, Ruth, back to the genealogy and what that all looks like. Stick with me. In Genesis 38, verse 4, Judah has two sons, Onan, Er. He's wicked, and the Lord takes his life. And we don't know what that means. So Judah tells Onan, you go in and do the brotherly thing. Take your brother's wife and raise up offspring for your brother. Well, it says in Genesis 38, that Onan goes in, but he spills his seed on the ground, and so the Lord takes his life. You go, dude, this is pretty serious stuff. So Onan is disobedient. And Tamar is the woman that is involved here. And she, then in Genesis 38, there's a whole story, it's kind of a odd story because it's stuck in between Genesis 37 and 39, in case you didn't. I should say it was for your sake. No problem. But it's kind of an odd story because it doesn't really fit the flow of events from Genesis 37 to 39. It seems to be stuck in there. And Judah tells Tamar, well, just hold your shorts on because I got a younger son. He's growing up, and as soon as he's all grown up, he can be your husband because that would be the custom. Except Judah, slips his mind, whatever, and Tamar dresses up as a prostitute. Judah goes into her, and the story carries on. But Perez is Judah's next child. Perez means the word Perez means to break through, to have a breakthrough. So there is a symbol here of the fruitful offspring. Perez is the fruitful offspring of Tamar, which she was denied from the youngest son, in much the same way that Boaz raises up offspring to Mahlon, Ruth's previous husband. And Obed is born because another refused. The kinsman redeemer before Boaz also refused to take Ruth as his wife, just as Onan refused to take Tamar. And so you see there's some coming together. There's a repeating, if you will, of history in some ways. And then we come to the Jewish people read the story, it's interesting, of Ruth on Shavuot, the Feast of Shavuot, Feast of Pentecost. Why would that be? Any ideas? What was Ruth doing during the story? Gleaning. Gleaning from what? The fields which were being harvested for the barley and the wheat. When is the Feast of Shavuot? The barley and the wheat harvest. And remember that at Pentecost, on the Feast of Shavuot, the Jewish people believed, the rabbis believed, I should say, that is when God gave the Torah. And since Ruth's name equals 606 plus the seven Noah laws given to Noah that all nations are enjoined to observe, that's the law of the complete commandments. So they read on the Feast of Shavuot, the Jewish people read the story of Ruth. It reminds them of accepting the Torah, the giving of the Torah. But the question is this: why a Moabite? Why did God have to get a Moabite woman to be in David's line? You got a prostitute in there, Tamar. Later on, we got Rahab. She was the one to bring David. In God's sovereign grace. Why? Moab is spared. If you read Deuteronomy 2 verse 9, God tells Moses, basically leave Moabites alone. Don't touch the Moabites. Well, and so for centuries, because of the command of God in Deuteronomy, Moab is left alone. Why? Where did Moab come from? Anybody know? From Lot. Very good. From Lot's daughters who committed incest with him. So why did they do that? Yeah, because they just saw what they saw was the end of the world, man. Raining fire and brimstone, Sodom and Gomorrah are gone. As far as they're concerned, Daddy and them is the only three left on the planet. So they commit incest and give birth to Moab and Ben-Ami, the father of the Ammonites. Okay, now stick with me. In Genesis, it talks about Terah. He's the father of Abram. He had three sons, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Three sons. Haran, the third one, has Lot, Milcah, and Iscah. They call her in Genesis 11, I believe. Two daughters and Lot. The rabbis believe, and it does not say this in the text, but the rabbis believe that Iscah was Sarai. Okay? Nahor, Abram's brother, marries Milcah, the daughter of his brother Haran. Abram marries Sarai, the other daughter of Haran. Sounds a little funny to me, but that's the way they did it. They get to the land. Abraham and Lot become wealthy. They have a lot of cattle. What does Lot do? He leaves. Why does he leave? Too much stuff. Okay? Exactly. Now, according to 2 Peter 2, verse 7, Lot was a righteous man. You don't read that in Genesis necessarily, but 2 Peter clearly says Lot was a righteous man whose soul was tormented, something along that line, by those wicked men of Sodom. Okay? But he separated himself for material reasons. In Jewish culture, does it matter the reason? If you separate yourself? Not so much. But he separated himself. God destroys Sodom, saves Lot, his wife, and his two daughters. And the wife didn't go so well. She thought she forgot her purse and looked back. Let that be a lesson. So the daughters commit incest in Genesis 19. Ruth comes from Moab. She marries Boaz, who is, and returns to Israel. Ruth is from Moab. Lot has separated himself from the line of Abram and his brother. Haran has separated himself, Lot has separated himself, and his granddaughter is Ruth. She rejoins Israel, if you will, through the line of Abram, and corrects, if you will, the sin of leaving by marriage to Boaz and by a steadfast love and yearning for God. It's a fascinating story, and I got it all written down here, and you know, to walk you through the genealogy is a bit much, but it's interesting how, let me think. Yeah, that'd be too confusing. Pardon me? Right?
He is the result.
That is correct. Yes. Yep. And we are not told the name of Ruth's lineage. So we don't, except we know she's a Moabite. and she's a grand. I take that back. We are told. But it's interesting that Terah, who has Abram, Nahor, and Haran, Nahor and Abram have their Isaac over here, and then Jacob and Esau, and then the 12 tribes. Nahor has 8 kids, Bethuel, who takes a wife, we don't know who. He has Rebekah. Rebekah and Laban are brother and sister. Jacob comes over and gets Laban's 2 daughters, Leah and Rachel, from which come the 12 tribes, from which come Judah, from which we get Tamar, the wife of one of his sons. And then it goes on, Perez, Hezron, Ram, Abinadab, Nashan, Salmon, Boaz. You got what?
I've got a
chart at home. Oh, that's scary. But Elimelech, what's interesting is God in his sovereignty took the incest of Lot's daughters with their father, took the separating of Lot from Abram because, man, I like the green stuff over here, and this is much better valley, and he left community. God sovereignly, providentially worked through all of that stuff to bring that line back into, restore it into Abram's line. He worked through what the Israelites would consider a pagan nation, the Moabites. Although we don't know where that got lost, because 2 Peter tells us that Lot was a righteous man. So somewhere it got lost in the shuffle. We're not sure. But what's interesting is that another part of Ruth that I find interesting is that Elimelech leaves, right in the beginning, the one whose name is God is my king, leaves Beit Lechem, the house of bread, and he goes to a field of Moab to open space. The one whose name is God is my king, who lives in the house of bread, goes to a place that's open, and he puts himself underneath the authority of another king, another nation. You're going, what were you thinking? Moab, historically, in Deuteronomy 23, refused to offer Israel food and water on their Exodus journey. Moab is part of the nation that tried to curse Israel in Numbers 21 and 22 through Balaam. Another interesting part is you see that we talked about the importance of names. In, you know, Naomi clearly says, don't call me that. Call me Mara. And the importance of the other names. But there's also the importance of the lack of names. In Ruth, in the beginning, it says, chapter 1, they're going to Moab from Bethlehem. They get wives. And now her husband and her sons are dead. And in chapter 1, verse 7, it says they departed from the place. Doesn't say they departed from Moab. They departed from the place. Chapter 1, verse 15. There's this discussion right before that between Ruth and Orpah, the two sister-in-laws, about, oh, we want to go with you. And Naomi says, no, just go home. And Orpah turns to go. And the next verse, it says, she says to Ruth, she doesn't say, Orpah. She says, your sister-in-law. Well, if I consistently refuse to name a person, what am I doing to that person or that country? I'm rejecting them. I'm removing their identity. I am saying that they are meaningless. So there's hints in the book of Ruth, at least in the beginning, that they went from Bethlehem to Moab, got sons, and now they're going to return. And we noted already that return often has spiritual significance of coming back to God. And so they're coming back to God, and in their coming back to God, they're leaving behind insignificant places and people, because they don't name the land, they don't name the person. Just something to put in your hat and think about, I think. And finally, in the book of Ruth, there's an interesting little Hebrew thing, and that is, it starts way back in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, that in Genesis 2, verse 4, it says, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth," which is always an odd phrase. How do earth and heaven have generations? But in that word, generations, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, it's toledot. There's six letters. The fifth letter is a vav. And the vav is kind of just a straight letter with a little hook on the end. And it's a connecting letter in Hebrew. It connects words. It connects paragraphs. It often starts a scroll in Hebrew because it's connecting it to the last scroll. A vav will be the first letter. Well, in Genesis 2, verse 4, is that before Genesis 3 or after? This isn't a trick question. It's actually before. So Genesis 2, verse 4 is before the fall. Before the fall, all was as it should be, right? Everything was as God had created it, and He Himself said it was very good. So there's a connection there. From that point on, from Genesis 2, verse 4 on, every time in Hebrew the word toledot shows up, there's only five letters. The vav is missing. It's as though the connection has been broken between heaven and earth. Because that's what 2 verse 4 says. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth. But from that point on, the connection is broken. And we see that in Genesis 3. And from Genesis 3 on to Genesis 12, you see just almost a continual breaking further and further apart. First of all, there's a connection broken between God and His creation, the people. Then you see a connection broken between God and the earth itself. It's now going to bring forth thorns and thistles. You see a connection broken between the supernatural and the natural in that in Genesis 5 or 6, you know, the sons of God coming into the daughters of women, and that is it's all getting screwed up. And all the way until you get to Ruth chapter 4, verse 18, for the first time, the vav shows up again. These are the generations of Perez, the one who breaks through, the one who is in the line of the Messiah. It's interesting. So not only do you see it in the language, in the very language itself, that God is doing a healing, if you will, a redeeming, if you will, in bringing the line of the Messiah back into sync, if you will. But we also saw it in the generations from Moab and Abraham, that God brings them back together again. God was doing a sovereign work in the book of Ruth. It's a story of God's sovereign grace, of God working through nations and lives, desperate times, famines, to bring about His sovereign will in this world. The book of Ruth is a story of, it's part of God's redemptive story in the larger biblical text, and it plays a key role in the story of Ruth and Boaz. Questions? Comments? Observations? And you thought it was only going to be 10 minutes. What were you saying about third John? Yes. Would they have been what now?
Having Jews going back and forth between the people of both places?
It's possible because we're told of this. I think there's clues in here that transmigration back and forth was happening more than just this little story. And the clue is that in the days of the judges, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Okay, so that means they were not following the law, which had clearly said, you do not marry foreign women. Okay, they were not following the law of being separate from. So it's very possible that this was happening, that people would migrate during times of famine to greener pastures. In God's eyes, does not negate the reason why they were migrating. It's because the land was under a famine, and the reason that was in biblical history was because they weren't holding up the covenant. Well, yeah. They would have known her story. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, these are Moabite women, or Ruth is a Moabite that she's bringing back. So she's bringing a foreigner into Bethlehem. And there seems to be, culturally a little bit of humor in this, that Ruth first goes out and gleans in the fields where the men are. Israelite women didn't do that. She didn't know any better. And so it's almost like Boaz tells her very politely, okay, next time, just go with my maids. You know, because she was clueless. The sense of her, the village no doubt knew. And it seems clear that when Naomi comes back, that she makes it clear that God, in her eyes, hasn't been very kind to her. But she also, when you get to the end of the story, she was empty, now she's filled. Because she's got Obed to help raise. And she has Boaz to take care of her in her old age. So it worked out well for Naomi in the end. But questions? Observations?
Can I make a statement?
Sure. That's why I have notes.
I notice his notes are thicker than ours.
Yes, they is. But no, there's a. Let me go back to the. If I can find it here. Let me finish with some of the names. Where are we? Ruth, the names. Oh, yeah. So Perez means to break through. He has a son called Hezron, which means a settled village or an abode. He has a son called Ram, means to become high or exalted, to become proud. Amminadab is my kinsman is noble. Nashan is to hiss or to whisper a spell. Salmon means a cloak or a mantle, a wrapper, and he's the father of Boaz, which means quickness. And you'll notice in the story that Boaz actually acts out his name. I mean, he is quick to notice Ruth to take her, if you will, under his care. Obed means to serve or to be a servant or a worshiper, which would all come from the same word. Jesse, David's father, is to stand out or he will return. And then finally, David means beloved or love itself. So the names, it's interesting just to follow some of those names through. And it's interesting if you ever want to do a study, get something that will tell you the names of the biblical characters and do a study from Seth on to like Enoch or the next 5 or 7, 10 generations. Just the names of the, you know, this one was born to this one and what their names mean. That is fascinating. Some you can look that up on the internet, and you got to take some of that with a grain of salt, but it's interesting how their names tell the story within the text. And of course, we don't pick that up because they just transliterate their names, not telling us what they actually mean. So, but okay, other questions, biblical questions. Forget Ruth. Okay, we're done with Ruth. What do you want to know about the love story of Ruth? She laid at his feet, said, "Marry me, dude." And they had to hold off the marriage because there was a closer kinsman, and he said, "No, I don't want her." So Boaz says, "Good." And the rabbis say they were married on the Feast of Shavuot, on the Shabbat. They say that David was born on the Shabbat, that David died on the Feast of Shavuot. I don't know. That's what they say. We don't know. I don't think the rabbis really know either. So they didn't have. No. Yes.
I think what Pat is referring to is the women studied the book of Ruth and the books of the Bible, and women present it differently.
Yeah, well, men. Men look at the Song of Solomon differently, too. So, hey, you know, what can I say?
You know, they lived out the men, they lived out their name. Whatever the name meant, they kind of lived out that. How did the parents before know that they were going to do that, to name them that?
I don't think they knew that so much as it became their destiny. But it's a picture because you raise a good question. Do people, do you know of people who were in high school, in grade school, teased mercilessly with a name? And now you see them all growed up. Do they still look like their name? A lot of times they do. We become what people call us. Don't we? I mean, if someone says you're a no good nothing, if you grew up and, you know, your parents or somebody's, you're never going to amount to nothing. If you could put a name in there, you know, my name is no good for nothing. I can almost guarantee you, unless something God does in this work, a lot of people grow up feeling, yeah, I'm worthless. I'm no good for anything. And you're going, well, that's not your name. Yeah, I know, but. And so we still see that. I mean, we see the reality of it. Here we're seeing it kind of in hindsight, almost in the rearview mirror. That, yeah. But.
Did you say that Ruth is the first woman's liver?
Is a what?
The first woman's liver.
Could be. Yeah, she would fit that category. Yeah. Her and Tamar. Right.
At the community center over there, and I spent the whole rest of the day looking for Winona's sister, Naomi, and she never showed up. It's a singing group. But
I'll believe you, Jim. You're talking about something before my time, I think.
Can you believe he doesn't know Winona and Naomi?
No, I don't know Winona and Naomi, sorry. I actually, I could play it too. I mean, like, I.
You got one of those vinyl?
I do. I do. So.
I can't believe, really.
Well, next week we're going to look at. I will see if we do 1 and 2 Samuel together, but probably not.
Say that again. My wife is talking in my ear.
Ah, terrible. We're going to do 1 and 2 Samuel, well, probably just 1 Samuel, so just read 1 Samuel from beginning to end.
I read all four of these chapters, and I never saw much of any of it. Duh. That's before my time, too.
But if you read I think the thing about reading the book of Ruth, and as we continue to walk through these books, is you are reminded again and again and again that what Paul said, I think, in 1 Corinthians 10, where these things were written for our instruction.
Okay.
There are lessons to be learned from Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and even Ruth. And go, what is God trying to tell us through these books?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's why today, I mean, I actually one time had somebody stand up in church. I was blown away. He stood up in church and actually said, we don't need the Old Testament anymore. I about had a canary. I say, excuse me. We are people of the New Testament. Do you know how many Christians actually think that? We don't need the Old Testament anymore. I'm going, excuse me. That's like getting the second half of a book and going, here, read it. Yeah, I know, but what happened in the first half? I don't worry about it. You know, well, how do I know what the story? 6 months later, that same man did come back and say, oops, I was wrong. So there's hope. But I have, and I remember we were had a Laotian congregation that used our building in Surrey, and Pastor Vong came one day. I came to work and he said, you aren't going to believe this. I said, what? He said, they just finished translating the Old Testament into Laos. He says, it's the first time ever we've had the Old Testament in our own language. He says, a lot of people, because they were immigrants, they only spoke Laotian. They had never read the Old Testament. He was so excited that they would finally get to read the first half of the book. Because imagine starting at Matthew and knowing nothing about Ruth, knowing nothing about Genesis or Exodus, knowing nothing about the kings or the judges. You're going, man, without that stuff as sort of a backdrop, you literally read the New Testament in a vacuum. So, okay. What the question is, what do you mean by that?
He came and he took that foundation that was laid. He came and he fulfilled all of the testament. But if you don't have the foundation, it's very hard to understand
what he was fulfilling. Exactly. Yeah, because if you don't have Leviticus, how do you read the book of Hebrews? I mean, just think about that once. Oh, you'd go, what's all this talk about sacrifices? What? This makes no sense. That's why you need the book of Hebrews or a book of Leviticus to actually understand the book of Hebrews. And that happens over and over and over and over and over again in the New Testament. Without understanding the Old, you will have missed something. So please don't neglect the Old, or shall I say the Hebrew Bible. The first covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they refer you back. When you're reading the New Testament, they refer you back to the Old, so that you wouldn't have anything to refer.
Exactly. So.
You can't understand Revelation unless you know the prophets.
Mm-hmm. You're right. There is, I mean, so anyway, just an encouragement. So, any other questions? We got a little time, folks. So. We kind of got out of the habit of the...